This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 229 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. So running back Josh Jacobs ran his pro day 40, and it was slower than we would have liked to see, at least for someone who is projected to maybe go in the first round of the draft. A lot of people like Jacobs. He's hard to scout with numbers because he didn't test at the combine, and he was in a split backfield with another pro at Alabama. But he certainly looks the part. He looks like he should be a pretty good NFL running back with the right pass-catching skills that are needed in today's game. But what I want to talk about before we get into today's mailbag questions are the responses to his 40 time. He ran in the 4.6s. Times were kind of all over the place, but let's just say that he ran a 4.6 flat. Plenty of running backs and plenty of successful running backs have run 40s with that time. One thing I think that we need to note, though, is that historically, pro day numbers are faster. So there should be some adjustment made there. I know sites like playerprofiler.com adjust pro day 40s. Player Profiler adds 0.05 seconds to those times. So let's just assume that Josh Jacobs' 40 is a 4.65, that he would have run a 4.65 at the combine. Does that really matter? In the end, when looking at him strictly as a football player, probably not. And he's had a groin injury too. But I found that speed score does seem to matter for running backs as they transition to the NFL. And more importantly, teams might care. If Jacobs has worse draft equity, that alone is a predictor that he might not be as successful. And the reaction from scouts on Twitter was another thing that I wanted to bring up. After his 40 times, there was just insane confirmation bias everywhere. People were saying how Kareem Hunt and Alvin Kamara ran slower than expected 40s, and how did that turn out? Well, Kareem Hunt and Alvin Kamara were third round picks. They weren't first rounders like so many people think that Josh Jacobs will be. This is where I think we can all get into trouble when scouting. There are a ton of reasons Alvin Kamara and Kareem Hunt panned out as players. Objectively, both guys had better production profiles than Josh Jacobs did. Jacobs was sharing a backfield with another pro, as I noted, and we can't discount that. But Kareem Hunt had well above average production at Toledo, and during his final season, Kamara killed it as a receiver. He didn't play the entire season, but he still had better market share numbers than Josh Jacobs did. And then there's landing spot. Look, I think both Alvin Kamara and Kareem Hunt would probably be good no matter where they were drafted. But you can't tell me that being in New Orleans and being under Andy Reid doesn't matter. It freaking matters. My point in saying all this is that when anyone starts to compare and contrast these single measurements without giving it any context, it's kind of irrelevant. And not only that, but for every Kareem Hunt success story, and I'm not talking about what's happened off the field, but for every Kareem Hunt success story, there's a handful of running backs who don't succeed at that 40 time. That's why looking strictly at something like speed score and saying, see, look, this successful running back also did this, is straight up confirmation bias. That's quite literally the definition of confirmation bias. But honestly, as I've talked about a lot on this show, testing is less about finding athletic specimens at running back specifically, and more about making sure that running back doesn't have serious red flags. Even if we adjust Josh Jacobs' 40 time to be a 4.65, at 220 pounds, his speed score is a 94. That's on the lower end of what you'd like to see, but it's not quite in the territory where he's absolutely going to bust. It's about thresholds. If he ran a 4.7 or worse, yeah, I'd be scared out of my mind to draft him. We really don't have examples of running backs running worse than a 4.7 who panned out significantly at the NFL level. But this isn't the reason to be worried about Josh Jacobs. His pro day 40 wasn't significantly bad enough to be worried, especially if he's battling a groin injury. What should worry you more is the question marks around his college production. Now, there's some reason for his lower market share numbers, but that doesn't completely dismiss things. And what if this injury is a big deal? That, to me, is the storyline, not his 40-yard dash and the comparisons to successful NFL players to make that narrative stronger. Now, before we get into this week's mailbag questions, I wanted to let all of you know that FanDuel is celebrating the start of the NBA playoffs with the Fantasy Playoff by throwing a huge yacht party in Miami, presented by Playboy. Keep up with all the NBA action, party with the playmates and celebrity guests, and watch a special performance by Flo Rida. Qualify now to earn your spot for a chance to join the celebration and compete for a share of $1 million in prizes by visiting FanDuel.com/fantasy. That's FanDuel.com/FANTASEA. This first question is from @Samaj0789. Am I crazy to think James Conner is a two-down back while Samuels handles passing down work? No, I don't think you're crazy at all. I do think Connor will be on the field plenty in passing down situations, but Jalen Samuels should have a role next year. And I said as much earlier in the offseason on my Dynasty Sells podcast. A lot of people look at Pittsburgh and note how they typically just use one workhorse running back. But a lot of that was due to competition. Le'Veon Bell obviously was always going to be a workhorse, and when he went down, D'Angelo Williams was the only viable option for a couple of years in Pittsburgh. And then when Bell was out this past year, the Steelers weren't going to throw Jalen Samuels back there right away. He was a rookie who didn't have a ton of experience playing the running back position. Now that we know what Jalen Samuels is capable of, I think he's going to see the field more than others think. So I think this is a very logical take, and Samuels does indeed lower Connor's ceiling in 2019. This next question is from @FFMarkS. Do you stream quarterbacks in dynasty leagues or focus on your own franchise quarterback? It's almost impossible to stream quarterbacks in dynasty because more quarterbacks are rostered. So no, I don't stream them, but I platoon them. Instead of investing in the quarterback position, I find a lot of QB2 types and play them by matchup. It's honestly a similar approach that I would take in a deep redraft league. And if I happen to come across a guy who becomes a great quarterback for multiple years for me, then great. If not, I'll be able to get production playing matchups with just a few guys. This next question is from @VeganFauxPlez. Is it safe to say that Gettleman is going to destroy Barkley's season like Arizona did to David Johnson's last year? Or will his talent supersede the ignorance of the Giants? Asking for a friend, LOL. I don't really see the two situations as that similar. In Arizona, you had a new coaching staff, a rookie quarterback, and an objectively bad offensive line. In New York, you've got at least some stability with the coaching staff. You have a quarterback who we can pick on, but will likely be better than what Josh Rosen was last year. And you've also got what will probably be a better offensive line. Now, I don't like projecting offensive line performance because there's so much that changes and fluctuates year over year. But a big problem for Johnson last year was that line. So no, I don't think this is a similar situation, and I would feel fine drafting Saquon Barkley next year. This next question is from @BeyoncésKnee. What is your strategy during a rookie draft? Do you pick by best player available or do you go by positional needs first? So I'm not a believer in the idea of best player available. I don't think it's a thing. It's sort of impossible for it to be a thing. This goes for both fantasy and real football. One of the first late round podcasts that I ever did was actually on this topic. So if you want to listen to it, it's episode 7. I will say it makes a little more sense from a fantasy perspective than it does in real football. Like in real football, when people said last year that Saquon Barkley was the best player available at pick 2, what in the living hell does that even mean? How can you say he's the best player without giving that any sort of positional context? It makes no sense. But with fantasy, I do think that we sort of understand positional value a little bit more naturally. Like no one is taking Kyler Murray at the 101 spot in single quarterback dynasty leagues because they know quarterbacks don't matter that much in fantasy football. But if we went about it the same way that they do in the real football world, we could say Kyler Murray is the best player available, so we have to take him because it's Kyler Murray. But that's completely illogical. Let's just assume best player available is given positional context, though. So basically, it's your turn to pick in the first round, and you're looking at a running back or a wide receiver. And this is probably what your question is asking. If you have a loaded wide receiver group on your team, do you still go after a wide receiver? Or do you take more of a need in running back? And my answer to that is, it depends. If the perceived gap between the wide receiver and the running back is massive, then I'm taking the most valuable asset, which would be the wide receiver. But if things are close, if there's not a big difference in how I view that wideout versus that running back, then I'll take the running back. I don't think you need to draft solely on need because unlike the NFL, it's very easy to make trades and turn your team around in fantasy football. You're only dealing with two main positions, so the trade-off is far different. This next question asks, is the fact that a lot of fantasy analysts say that this rookie class is, quote, landing spot dependent, indicative of an overall talent deficiency? Don't we usually fade guys who we say, oh, he's in a good spot to produce when compared to guys who are more talented? I think landing spot is amazingly important for all draft classes. Ignoring landing spot for talent for fantasy purposes can get you into a lot of trouble. Situation matters, scheme matters, coaching matters, all of that matters. To ignore that because a player is good in your eyes will get you into trouble in the long run. Because not only can a good situation help, but you're assuming that you know who the more talented player is overall. And we know that we're going to be wrong all the time with player evaluation. Now, the reason this class in particular is so landing spot dependent is because there aren't many blue chip running backs. And you could probably say the same at wide receiver. But there's no Christian McCaffrey or Ezekiel Elliott. That means there aren't players who are guaranteed to see a workload no matter where they go. Instead, it's going to depend on where they land and the competition that they see in their new spot. It's fine to have takes in the feel for which running backs are better than others. And as I've said, I don't think running backs are very important in real football, but coaches should be striving to be rational and putting the most talented backs in starting roles. And if they're in starting roles, they're going to get volume. So the talent equation still matters, but we can't let that completely overshadow situation. This next question is an email. It says, JJ, who sharpens you? Who are some of the fantasy football folks that you found yourself better for having studied? Appreciate your work 69 times over. Nice. Thanks, Kevin. I love this question. If I'm being honest, a lot of what I do with other fantasy football analysts is bounce ideas back and forth. So it's less about studying what they do and more about the conversations that I have with them. And that includes a number of different people. I'd say that Rich Rebar of RotoWorld is my go-to if I have some idea or feel a certain way about a player. He's sort of my gut check because he and I think about this stuff in a pretty similar way. And I think that we can all agree that we've gotten a lot smarter through reading Evan Silva's matchup column each week as well. But it would honestly take me like an hour to name everyone that I've conversed with who have helped me be a better analyst. One thing I do want to say, though, is that I think it's really important to study what's going on outside of your own industry. So I'll do my best to read things from regular football guys, not just fantasy football ones. But even going beyond that, I'm a big fan of the bigger names like Tim Ferriss and Gary Vaynerchuk as well. People might not know this, but a huge reason I wrote the late round quarterback ebook that sort of kicked off my career was because of Tim Ferriss's 4-hour workweek book. And then Gary V is just a great person to listen to and take information from because he makes you think. He makes you look at the bigger picture. And when you can have those perspectives about industries that may have nothing to do with yours, you're able to sort of attack things on your own that haven't been attacked before. Such a big part of what I do is about marketing just as much as it is about the analysis. It's about packaging up the analysis in a way that's consumable and in a way that resonates with an audience. That's why listening to someone like Gary V talk can be really impactful. And that's why hearing Tim Ferriss's life hacking perspective or the perspective of the guest that he has on his podcast, it really helps me think a little bit differently. So this is a long-winded way of saying that the people who sharpen me with what I do goes well beyond the awesome fantasy analysts that are out there. And I do really appreciate that question. This last question is from @DynastyAddict. What is the ideal pass-to-run ratio for NFL teams? In general, should they be passing more or less? Does this depend on how good the quarterback is? So this is a question that I'm not really capable of answering, if I'm being honest. I don't study this type of thing as much as others do who are a lot smarter than I am. But I can at least answer it in sort of a philosophical way. We know that passing is much more efficient than rushing is. Every pass is adding far more expected points than a rush is. That doesn't mean that rushing is irrelevant. As you noted, personnel has to play a role here. Not all quarterbacks are capable of providing more expected points per dropback as the team would have per rush. But I will say, over the last 5 seasons, according to NumberFire's expected points model, only 30 teams finished a season with more expected points per rush than per dropback. That's about 6 teams per season. So what that means is that for the majority of NFL teams, passing is going to be more impactful than running. But to your question, no team has really tested this. Like, we don't really know what the break-even point is to where passing becomes less advantageous than rushing. There are certain scenarios on a football field where rushing is a better option. But in terms of overall philosophy, we just don't know. All we know is that it's currently smart to do what you can to enhance your passing game. That's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to everyone for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. And if you're on iTunes, please do me a favor and leave a rating and review. And you can also follow me on Twitter @LateRoundQB. Thanks, everyone. Have a great weekend.